So anyone who doesn't want to be recorded has to not speak. So I still have if John, if you're listening, I still think we've got John Maynard. Who, I think, did anyone remember John?
John Maynard Keynes.
John, no.
I don't think John, Frederico would know him.
Yeah.
And Anthony would know him.
Yeah. So, and never mind, we're talking about John, but anyway, I think I have someone in India listening to, who's following the class. So, you know, we're reaching across the globe.
How did you get them?
Well, no, John was staying at my mum's place and came to the last class. And he was just in exile, really, trying to get back to India. And now he's back. Hello, John. I think you might be listening. Yes. So, I'll have to send him an email to make him listen now. I was thinking about Heidegger again this morning, and I know that it's almost inevitable you go Heidegger Nazi. I don't know, it's hard not to do that. So I thought, seeing as we're dealing with Heidegger up front, I'll just say something about that
Catherine Nazi, don't forget that. He's got both the evils of the world.
What I was hoping was if we deal with it, and then we might be able to put it to bed. I know maybe we can't put it to bed, but my reflection on Heidegger is entirely, for me, about reading his philosophy. So I haven't looked into the black books and the various... I mean, I know a few of the quotes that are there, and there's been a lot of controversy about the fact he was an anti-Semitic, and the black books demonstrate that. But I think that the deepest concern with Heidegger was... Okay, he joined the Nazi Party in 1933... in order to become rector of Freiburg University. And he thought at that time that he was going to be some kind of transformative influence on the German nation. He was going to become the philosopher of the German people. And I think he had some quite grandiose ideas about how it was all going to unfold, and I think he soon realised it wasn't going to unfold like that. That the party wasn't quite open to what he had in mind, and he gave up the rectorship, and just carried on being a philosophy professor while remaining a member of the party right till the end of the war, and then saying nothing about it after that. And I think that the thing that made it sort of unacceptable for many people was his silence and his absence of showing any public contrition for having been associated with the party, and for the effect that it would have had on all the people who thought that Heidegger was... It was a tremendous validation of the party that Heidegger joined in for the people who, like us, you know, who were attuned to his philosophy, and which had some, I think we're going to agree, had some depth to it. Here's my take on it at the moment, I think I'm beginning to notice over the years that I don't really understand Heidegger's philosophy fully. I mean, it's arrogant of me to say I understand it fully before he joined the party, but certainly after, there's an admixture of material in what Heidegger speaks of, which I don't follow. I don't even wish to judge it. I just mean that he moves into dimensions, particularly in his later essays after the war, where it becomes what you might say semi-poetical, and he moves into areas where my ability to have an intuitive understanding of what he's saying only goes so far. Around the being and time and either side of it, for me, he reached a level of great clarity. And I often find that when I'm teaching Heidegger, I stick in that period, you know, pre-33. But even before, around 1925 to 1933, I feel he had a period. If you're going to look at it as a pathological case, he had a period of lucidity. For me, but I don't. I have great respect for Heidegger, so I don't wish to. Because for quite a long time, I didn't understand what he was saying, even in that period. You know, it took me quite a long time to become, and he, I think, his word would be attuned to what he was talking about. So I'm not ruling out the possibility that I'll become attuned to his later work, later. But certainly, I feel like in my experience of life, he became morally compromised.
I think he was morally compromised from the beginning. There are thousands of books now about the relationship between Catholicism and Nazism and fascism. Particularly, for instance, The Mass Psychology of Fascism by Reich. But there are many, many stories. And the claim is, and it's a fairly well-supported claim, that it's the authoritarianism in Catholicism that actually gives rise to the authoritarianism in fascism. Now, Reich, Heidegger was born a Catholic. He was raised in a Catholic.
Can I hold you there, Michael?
He stayed with the Catholic.
Can I hold you? Because I'm giving a kind of my account is not. It's about my own journey with Heidegger.
Yeah, but I'm here I'm here too. You know, I mean,
Yes.
I don't bow to everything you say. I'm here. I've got a right to an opinion too, and my opinion is.
Yes,
if you understand Heidegger.
No, Michael.
Properly,
Michael, I was in the midst of.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I know you. I'm not saying you. Am I saying you? I don't recall saying you've got no right for an opinion.
No, you didn't actually say it.
No,
you enacted it.
No, I was trying to say I'm in the midst of something here.
Yeah, okay. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, and you want to say your piece, but I'm in the midst of something here, and where you're coming from is quite different, as I mentioned last week, from where we are in the class, or I am in the class.
Oh, I know that. Yeah.
I'm aware of that. Yeah. And I can't help. I mean, being honest myself, but disagree with you at a fundamental level, and I don't want the class to turn into me disagreeing with you, Michael.
No.
And that doesn't mean you've got no right to an opinion.
So you can agree
it
with me.
It means something like you jumped into it at week 7, and I'm asking you.
But
to,
I've read it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying you don't. You're not knowledgeable about this. I'm saying.
Anyway, continue. Sorry, I do apologise.
Yeah, no.
I just wanted to say that there's a totally opposite view to what you're making. That he was always a fascist. He was always an authoritarian. He was always.
But you made that point.
Yeah.
In effect, imputing to me something I don't remember saying.
No, I didn't say you said that. You were sort of trying to put it to bed.
You see,
and I think it can never be put to bed.
And I don't recall I was putting it to bed.
Oh, you said that.
So
you'll find that on the.
Have I come in at the red tape?
Yes. I don't recall saying I put it to bed.
Well, you said roughly that on the tape.
No, I didn't say that, Michael. And that's what I mean. You see, where I think there's a certain way of doing philosophy where this kind of disagreement is considered fruitful. So we dive in and we find out who's right, who's wrong. So-and-so said that, Reich said that, John's opinion says this, and there is another point of view over here. And in fact, it's if you don't point out that other point of view, you're not doing your philosophical job. Yet, but I guess what I was trying to say last week is we're not doing that kind of philosophy here. And it's not that you don't have a right to an opinion, it's just that we're trying to not express our opinions about Heidegger, but to come to an understanding of what he was indicating. And then, you know, possibly once we've reached such an understanding, we might be in a position to start to form an
So I mean, I'm not understanding without context.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm. I think if you just let the class unfold, mm-hmm. we're just going to go into what Heidegger's talking about.
Yeah, you keep on unfolding, and I'll keep myself to limited comments. Okay. Do unfold.
No, but in a way, also I find it disturbing to get into an altercation. With okay. you know.
It's the Jewish way, isn't it? It's dialectics. It's part of my character.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, but I'm asking you in a way once again
to deculturalize.
If you could join into the culture that's already here, which we've already made, it would. I'd appreciate it. I can't. Of course, I can't demand it. So, back to where was I? Yes, with Heidegger. So this is my. I'm just explaining my reading of his philosophy as it's arisen in me, that he became morally compromised, and that's by his actions, and by his not saying anything about it afterwards. And I'm just guessing. That, and this is only a conjecture, that had an effect on his philosophizing. I don't think we can just separate them out. I'm just putting that down. If you do get into reading Heidegger, whether you too recognize some kind of change as Germany changed, because I almost think that Heidegger's fate as a philosopher was tied up with the fate of Germany itself. But for my own understanding of Heidegger, all I can say is I generally only pick pieces that I feel a sense of understanding about, because I can't really teach that. And I'm coming round to the fact that if any of you read the beginning of this course. It said a lot about we're going to be looking at this essay, The Way to Language. And I'm not sure we're going to. I've got a feeling at the end of the course I might just give it to you and say, all right, we've dealt with language up to now. Here's Heidegger's kind of pinnacle essay on language, but I don't really understand it. In the way that... you have to have a sufficient understanding or clarity to teach something in a way. But we may read it anyway. We'll see how far we get. If we read it anyway, it'll be week 10. We'll look at it in week 10. But for those of you who've done the reading this week, it's not obviously about language. I mean, it is about language, but it's more about world. But if you remember last week, we were looking at Bortov and his... he was saying that to say world and language is kind of almost incorrect because you can't take them apart. And I was in a way hoping that when you look at Heidegger, you hold these two things in mind. Because there was a point last week when Bortov was talking about concepts.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
And how we I should have brought the slide up, but he was talking about when we point or designate things, we already have the concept. And I was, do you remember? I was stuck on that. I thought that wasn't the right language. And I think this week, Heidegger's going to say it himself rather than Bortov saying it. Because I feel it's important we go back to what Heidegger's saying, because really Bortov took his ideas in that book largely from Heidegger and Gadamer. And I don't. I was saying then, I don't think Heidegger would say that when we have water in front of us and we designate it or point to it, really behind that we have the concept of water. He'd say more what he's saying here, which is we have the manifestness of beings as such already present to us. And he doesn't want to define that. I think the point of Heidegger and what he's doing here is he wants to lead is maybe the wrong word. He wants to indicate what that means without defining it by drawing people into a certain realization of what that means. So what Bortoff was trying to say, and last week it was all about that moment with Helen Keller and the water and her suddenly getting language and that being a tremendous revelation for her, and the idea that there's something about language that reveals the world to us that's far more fundamental than our just pointing to the table. Because we that sense that we point to the table, but the table's not something linguistic. There's all this stuff, and then we've got language, and then we use language to point to all this stuff. And Bortoff was trying to say, well, no, there's a deeper connection between the world and language that isn't, as we think of it, a kind of a using words to point stuff out that we already, in some sense, understand. And he's kind of trying to say, well, yes, we do already understand what we point out, so therefore we already have language. But Heidegger doesn't say it in that way. He wants to indicate something that he does finally, and I think this is also for Michael, a mystery. That there's a certain mystery here in the manifestness or the manifestation, the manifestness of being, that one has to experience. So, that's my introduction, and he wants now to examine language. And I did. I don't know who did do the readings, but I know that John in India and Maria were both wondering about the Greek. I don't know if you got my post about that.
I got about 6 pages in.
Yes.
And then I was like, oh, he's a Nazi, I'm not going to bother.
Yeah.
He's an excuse. He's a, not with
he's a Nazi and there's a lot of Greek. But there wasn't, you know how it is when something, there wasn't a lot of Greek. There were only a handful of words. And they're all from Aristotle, you know, and they're probably worth, my suggestion, if you read it on the chat, was that you do what I did, which is you go and look at the Greek alphabet, you find the nearest English letter, and you do the substitution, and generally you see something there that looks familiar. You know, logos is, well, the other thing then is then you say, oh, and then I want to translate the word. But of course, these are philosophical terms, and the translation isn't back into, you know, ordinary. It's not, you're not going to get the meaning from a Greek phrase book. You know, the meaning of the word really emerges out of the understanding of the philosophy. So there wasn't a simple, I know what was wanted was a little lexicon that, you know, here's the Greek word and it means this, and it's not quite so simple, but some of these words are part of this background that hopefully I can elucidate a bit in the lecture about the logic of the assertion, the logic of the proposition. Because Heidegger's spent a lot of time attempting to indicate that the language of the propositional language is secondary to something that precedes it. You could say almost this whole reading was there's something that precedes propositional language, and he doesn't here at this point say that it's language. He wants to indicate that it's something far deeper than that. It's the essence of Dasein, or an aspect of the essence of Dasein, of what it means to be human. Of the well, let's get into this. So I think I'm going to. Everyone's gone really quiet now. I feel it's you could have gone too quiet now. I'll read it.
Do you want a nut? Would you like a nut?
No. So truth, falsity, and freedom. So this is my another interesting thing about what I did here was I actually for the slides I just copied the whole text into the slides because I thought I couldn't really shrink it down. Mm. And then the more I read it, the more you get to a point where you start to, I think if you get really into a Heidegger's writing, you do discover, oh no, I thought I needed everything he said because everything seems so significant. And then you get to another side where you think, he's just saying the same thing over and over. It's quite strange. Because there is, after a while, if you read it carefully, there's a tremendous amount of him saying the same thing in different ways. I mean, he admits this. He's circling around something. He's circling around something that, in a way, is terribly simple unless you don't see it.
Can we, before you start reading it, can you just say a few things about the meaning of logos? And I know it's a Greek word and you can't translate it, but I always thought it meant word. But it obviously doesn't mean that, does it?
Well, in the beginning was the Word, and in the Bible, in the beginning was the Logos, which you could say it's almost the capacity for speech. Would that do? Again, I'm just stabbing at it.
You referred to the Bible there, but
yes.
We're not talking about theology here, are we? We're talking about philosophy.
Yes, but in the original, in the Bible, it was logos in the beginning was the word.
And Heidegger uses the word logos, does he?
But it's not. It's Aristotle's use of it that he's referring to, not the Bible.
Okay.
But I'm just using it in the sense that those of us had a bit of a, I know you did, a bit of a Christian background. The sort of meaning of the word in the Bible is that God almost spoke everything into existence, and the logos has some echo of that in it. It's got this deeper sense that it's the very capacity of us to articulate meaning. But the logos apophantikos, which is if you got as far as translating the first bit of Greek in there. Is apophantic logic, the logic of the proposition. So the apophantikos is narrowing it down to language insofar as it makes assertions or propositions or statements that such and such is the case, as opposed to get out of the room. You know, that's an instruction. You know, there are various ways that we use language, but in philosophy, particularly analytic philosophy, it became very focused on statements of that form, which Heidegger, in his example, says can be the kind of classical simple thing is the board is black. He didn't say the blackboard is black, but that's what he meant. By the way, if you're picturing where he was, he's in a lecture theatre in the days when you actually had blackboard and chalk, which I do like to, every time I say that, the greatest Heideggerian that I met in person was Hubert Dreyfus at Berkeley, and he did teach with a blackboard and chalk, and that was not that long ago. He's died now, but early 2000s. So I thought I'd like to let you know that in some of the great universities of the world, they still have blackboards.
He just had a book too.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't have slides, he had the book.
Yeah, he just had the book. He was teaching Greek though then, Greek.
Yeah.
Yeah, why do people favour whiteboards over blackboards?
Well, whiteboards, because
blackboards,
it's the chalk. You know, chalk appears better on black.
Yeah.
Yeah. But chalk is scratchy, slow, and kind of horrid to use.
Makes good noise.
Yeah. No. As a teacher, I can understand. You write faster with a pen on the whiteboard than chalk on a blackboard. I think if you were doing it, you'd say, "I think I'll use the whiteboard." Just for it's all ease of use, isn't it? So where were we?
I asked about what logos.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Propantikos.
Yes. So we're looking at a very narrowed down form of language here, where we're making statements that about beings. Yes.
Sorry, when you talk about that, I remember seeing these people talking about this Japanese chalk. Have you heard of that? This really posh thing that now all the lecturers are kind of bragging about using this Japanese chalk.
Oh, well, maybe.
It just shows you how even something like writing with chalk on a blackboard becomes something you can start bragging about.
It's a lifestyle choice. Yeah.
You know, I went and I got like 10 packets, so I'm never running out of all this Japanese chalk. You know, this
Japanese stationery is way better. I ordered some pencils from Japan and they're just.
Absolutely, well, don't forget the chalk as well.
And fountain pens.
So, we're.
Sorry.
So, the revealing and concealing of logos.
We'll make it over.
Yes, truth and being false, truth or falsity, the possibility of both. So he actually, I've just chopped out a huge section. You know, there's loads in this book where he does go into what is the logos, and you haven't read that as far as Aristotle understands it, because Heidegger, you know, part of his philosophical understanding is that. It's kind of myth of philosophy. It's something like the Greeks actually encountered the manifestness of being that he wants to introduce us to. And they, in a way, were the first to conceptualize it. And we inherited their conceptualization, even though we don't speak Greek. The whole culture comes out of the manner in which the Greeks understood this primordial manifestation of being, and he has a great respect for Aristotle and Plato, but particularly for Aristotle, because he thinks Aristotle was actually there, and in a way was grappling with the thing itself, and that subsequently we've just been grappling with our idea of things, and that in order to open the question up again, which is his great question at this point, is the what is the being of beings? Which in a way it's got a kind of a tautological doesn't what's the being of beings as a kind of that doesn't mean anything, just thrown at you like that. You know, he's kind of saying, well, even to get to understand the question that I'm asking, we have to go back into this. We have to reawaken this original past that's become sedimented in us. So that's part of why he's going back to Aristotle. So the revealing and concealing of logos, those of you, I think Maria and a few others, in our previous course we did talk about aletheia, the Greek word for truth, being unconcealing. So the idea of truth as unconcealing. Again, Heidegger thinks that it got lost in our tradition. We don't think of truth as unconcealing anymore. We think of truth as the sort of matching of some proposition to some state of affairs in the world, and we say that the proposition is true. The board is black because it matches the state of affairs in the world, and truth is correspondence. It's called. So we've got. State of affairs, statement, they correspond, that's truth. And Heidegger wants to say, well, no, that's a sort of secondary truth. And I'm not going to elucidate that because that's indeed what we're talking about. But he's talking here about the more primary truth is the unconcealedness of being in the first place. It's only once being in a sense has become manifest to us could we start to make assertions about it. He's trying to say that something that precedes our ability to use apophantic logic. And he also wants to indicate that there are these dimensions of apophantic logic or the language of statement that it can be both used to reveal or conceal. Language can be used to state or to say that the world is in such and such a configuration when it isn't. And we can use language to conceal the way things are by making things appear to be what they're not. So we've got this capacity of language to reveal and conceal. And in that sense, it can be true or false. And then there's this other dimension of capacity of language, which is we can point towards something and away from it using negation. So you can say the board is not white. And in a way, that's a pointing away from the board, saying what it's not. So we've got these dimensions of attributing something to something or negating it, revealing it or concealing it. And they're all intertwined in this capacity of the logos to point things out. And he wants to say here that, I mean, something in this first sentence is what the next few slides are going to be about anyway, that he doesn't use the word hover, but it's like we have this capacity to in our assertions to be of truth or falsity in the way that we speak, and that in this capacity there is a freedom, an essential freedom in us. We can in a sense choose to conform to being. Now
they have the freedom to conform.
Oh, I'm going to tell them to be quiet.
No, don't. There are hosts right here. You know, I think I we'll see how we'll see if they go away. Right. I don't think they might just be having a
problem. It's essential freedom to conform to being.
Yes. So as we go into it, you know, he talks about binding.
Yeah, I didn't understand.
Yes.
That, sorry.
So this is good that you. Because in a way, that's kind of the heart of the lecture's in that. Yes.
So, logos apophantikos, that's secondary. So logos in itself, is that primary?
Well, in the way that he's using, I wouldn't like to say. I don't think he would say that logos is primary. I think he leaves it in a way unsaid. Hello? You see, the later Heidegger is going to talk about language. In a way as distinct from logos as he's using it now. And the manner in which he's using logos now he's talking in the manner in which Aristotle used it. So he's going to come to a much broader understanding of what language is than this Greek conception of logos. So do you see it's not... But you could equally well say, well, in effect, he's just expanded the meaning of logos. But he doesn't actually speak like that.
he's taking Aristotle's logos and then bringing it into his own understanding.
He's taking logos to be logic, and he's taking logic to be the way the West thinks now. It's the way we think now. He's not just talking about Aristotle. He's saying it's the way we think now. It's our mode of understanding. In the language of this course, you could say it's the language of the left brain. You know, in that sort of bigger myth that we've been sort of looking at, you could say that there are two languages here, right? There's the language of designation that we are more or less entirely engaged with in our everyday lives, and then there's a deeper language of disclosure. You know, that's what we were talking about last week. Which again, you could say it's like that place of disclosure is what we were referring to as the background, broad attention of the right brain. That's where, the disclosure is happening. I'm just giving you a model here, right? Coming back to that, we've got to remember this left brain, right brain idea is an unproven theory, but it gives us a kind of a a metaphor. You know, I think we like to get a picture, and a great metaphor for people like us, I think, in our time, is to have a scientific metaphor. I think we're more attuned to something like that. So within that, if you've got a grasping of what the difference between the left and the right brain is, you've got a sort of a sense that the logos is left brain's explicit language, where things are divided up and fixed. And there's another background to that language, which is the event of language, if you like. And Heidegger, just in a way like this course, I mean, my understanding of what he's doing here is he's taking this explicit language and he's attempting to express what lies behind it.
Oh, behind
the
Western way of
yes.
thinking.
Yes, yeah, yes.
So what is this binding thing?
So, I won't hurt to say it twice. Because it's crucial and it's elusive. One way to look at it is you can be in a complete projection of what you think is the case. Yes, and all you see in your understanding of the world is you see the world as you think it is. Yes, you just go around and you just see what you already think, and putting it in an extreme way, and that could become very extreme. Heidegger is talking about being open to being is a relinquishing of that, so that what you perceive or what you experience is an allowing of the being that you're encountering to determine what you experience, which means you bind yourself to that being, which is a kind of a in your freedom to dream anything you want to dream and to project anything you want to project. You surrender that freedom and you say, no, I'm going to allow this being here to determine what I'm seeing.
But how can a being determine something without using language?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that. Except insofar as I think he's talking about something that is an actual experience that we're having all the time. Whenever we look at something, and we just allow it to appear to us, we bind ourselves to that cup.
And that is classroom, we're binding ourselves to each other in a way.
Yes.
Not in a we're being here and we're binding ourselves to each other in a certain way that we're in a class with you and somebody else has come in the room. And,
yeah. I don't understand, how do you if I've got a preconception, so for instance, if I decide in advance I'm coming to a class and I have a preconception that it will be set out in rows and the teacher will be at the front and all the rest of it, and I come in here, allowing myself to be bound by the reality of what I actually see is to say, this is also a classroom. Sitting in the round is also a classroom. Is
well,
that
there's what a, you mean? There's a sort of, I mean, in our... The bad example, these are not good examples because they're all things that are so familiar to us that you know, in this, that what we expect to see is what we see. So there's hardly any, if you're moving in the realm of the familiar, I'm talking about this state of projection. In most of the time, your state of projection actually corresponds to what is, because you're just moving in a habitual circle. Yes, the allowing beings and binding will occurs when you allow something new.
Okay, how about
I think the best example, for instance, for us.
Yeah.
It's in our relations with each other. When that's my immediate example.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this relations with others, actually, because you can't really determine what someone else is thinking, can you?
No. But
so
you think you can.
You think you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's always that ambiguousness, isn't there?
Yes. Yes, I mean, it's particularly important with another human being that you... This is where you can see the leeway opening. You know, where if you feel that you know someone and you've got a fixed picture of who they are, you don't open up any leeway for them to be what they are. And what you see, if you do open up that leeway, then Heidegger's saying, actually, there's a binding going on. You're giving up your freedom to invent what's in front of you in a way, and you're binding your experience to allow the other to determine what you're experiencing. Do you get a glimpse of it there? Yes.
I just think I kind of understand it slightly differently, this sentence, and as much as. What I think that he meant was that if you allow that, because he said the possibility of both, so that it's like what you think can be true but also can be false, when you accept that possibility, that is having a freedom of some sort from being attached to whatever your logos is telling you. So when you have this, then you give the possibility for something to have a binding character, and I think what he means by that is that it's actually the true character, the binding character. It's like that is the actual character that's kind of binding from the meaning of an agreement is binding. You can't escape. You know, something is binding.
But it sounds very. He's not as fixed as that. Let me give you another example that may ring a bell. I particularly get this. There's a certain with trees in the sunlight when the breeze is blowing on the leaves. I don't know what I think. Maybe you all have things like this that might. There's the tree starts to speak to me. No, I don't mean hello John. I don't mean that. I mean the tree starts to speak to me about its being a tree in a way that you can't be expressed any better than the way that its leaves are shimmering and moving in the breeze.
Yeah.
You can't say it any better, because that's the language of the tree. The tree is expressing what it is to you.
He's making very heavy weather of a very simple concept, I think. And it's this, you can find a metaphor in quantum physics of interpenetration. But what he's basically talking about is the functional, the sensory, which is the object has a use and it's objectified. And he's talking about the feeling world, where you identify with things without barriers. And so you get a feeling from something like the tree talking to you, or the sea waving at you, or whatever. And he's talking about these two basic fundamental human capacities. He's making a mistake in putting one before the other, I think, as one is more important than the other, because one is about physical survival, and the other is the reason, the enjoyment of that physical survival. So I think he's making a lot of heavy weather of something which is fairly clear. You can find it in Jung, you can find it in quantum physics, you can find it in Eastern philosophy, but you can't find it in, well, he's having difficulty with it, basically, for some reason. I won't go into the reason why he's having difficulty, because then we get into an argument. But but I think that's what he's talking about. So when you talk about the meaning of something, like falling in love, you no longer take the person and make an object of them and say, they're going to do this for me, they're going to do that for me. You actually interpenetrate, you actually let them inside you. You're vulnerable. You're in the world of feeling. And I think that's the concept he's playing with there, basically. If that makes sense to you. Yeah. So you've got feeling on the one side, and you've got the thing that he hates, the Catholic Church hates, which is rationality on the other side. He thinks the world is over-rational. And, you know, the objects are seen as objects because we're going to use them in relation to others. This is relativity. Quantum, on the other hand, is about interpenetration. So it's about feeling. So you've actually got this in physics now as well. You can actually talk about this whole thing in physics. So it's moved well on from where he was struggling. I'm sure he was part of the struggle to get there, you know. So I'll give him that much credit.
Yes. Yes. So, yes. So, Michael, you know, there. So you've wrapped it up.
No. There's a lot more to it than
yes,
that.
But in a way, I don't know if you see the... Because, in fact, you're kind of an example of what we're talking about.
Of course.
This is you understanding Heidegger, as in getting around Heidegger.
No. Understanding means standing under. It means going to the world of feeling and seeing what motivates his intellect.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
No. You're getting your conceptual understanding around Heidegger, aren't you?
Not particularly. Heidegger is just he's only relevant in understanding fascism to me. He's got no other
report. So you're not aware that that's what you're doing?
Well, you could say that if you want, but you can't, you know. I mean, that's just, I know and you don't know. It's an old Catholic thing. It's authoritarianism. I don't accept that you can say to me, you're aware. I know that you're not aware of what you're doing. Because I can say, look, I can look at your subconscious and look at that anger. Look at this, look at that. And you're not aware of any of those things that are motivating you. That's a bad world to get into. That's a very nasty world to get into, I think, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
Tell someone that they're not aware of something in themselves is like raping them almost. And the more clarity in your perception of that, the more it's a rape.
I see it was a mistake. Sorry, Michael. Yeah. See it was a mistake.
Anyway, yeah,
I won't endeavour to point anything out to you.
No, I
see it's good. I do see it's a mistake.
Just don't delve into people's subconscious, because then you're raping them. It's not nice.
No, I'm sorry if you feel that I was doing that.
It's a proposition.
Yeah. No, I see that.
You know, whatever I say today, I might be wrong about that.
I'm sorry, Michael. I can't.
No, don't apologize.
No, I mean, I'm sorry, not to you. I'm sorry.
Oh, you mean you're sad?
I'm sorry that we can't communicate. But that's.
We are communicating.
I'm sorry from my side I'm unable to communicate what I wish to say to you.
Well, I think you are. I'm hearing it, yeah, but I'm not going to go into the subconscious of it.
Yes, I'm sorry. Anyway, Michael, but the I can't engage.
It's just an expression.
Yeah. But I'm not.
I mean, the feeling.
No, can we stop?
It's a
can we?
Question of philosophy has ever been.
Can we?
The idealist on one side, the materialist on another side.
Can we stop, Michael?
And they're not actually different.
Can we? So, yes. Yeah, I can't continue at the moment.
Do you want to take a break?
Just do five.
Just let me. I just need to gather myself. Get back to what we were talking about. The tree. We were talking about the tree. Yeah. So, I'm not sure if I communicated anything there about that there's that behind the ordinary manifestation of a tree where you just say, oh, it's a tree, it's an ash tree, I know what it is, and you walk on. There's a capacity for certain, it particularly seems to be in nature, where if you pause and you open in a certain way, not because you've even done it deliberately, it's almost like you catch something in the manner in which something is manifesting, which is revealing something to you about the being of that, or whatever it is.
Yeah, whether or not it's poisonous or not.
Yes, but I'm talking more about the that there might be a hidden dimension here to the manifestation of being, yeah, that we're generally not in touch with. Yeah.
I think that experience is different for different people, though, because in, I don't know if you've read Sartre's Nausea?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
There's a section in it where he's staring at the root of a tree, and suddenly that tree reveals itself to him. In all the fullness of its being, it impacts on him as a tree root, beyond just saying, oh, that's a tree root. You know, he experiences the being, and for him, that brings nausea, brings a terrible fear and horror to see things as they really are.
Yes.
So that experience for him was different from perhaps your experience of a tree.
Yeah.
How can we be separated from the fact that it's our experience of it, even if it reveals itself to us in all its treeness or whatever? It's going to be different for Sartre as it was for you. I don't see how you can escape from the subjectivity.
No. So I'm, and I don't know that I can answer that.
Okay.
Because I don't know what Sartre. I mean, I'm reading Nausea. I don't want to analyse Sartre.
No.
I can only speak from my own experience, but I'm not saying that you should experience something like that with a tree. I'm trying to indicate something that can occur when you, because we're talking about binding, right? Mm. When you no longer are fixed in your own interpretation of things, you allow something else to speak to you. And in that allowing something else to speak to you, it doesn't have to be a tree, it can just be another human being. There's a binding in that you're giving up a certain power that you have to just dream your dream, if you like, and you're allowing something else. I mean, when we say determine your experience, I don't know if you've got an idea that means you're going to take over your mind. It's not like that. It's just
that. So I'm saying that people experience that or react to it, if you like, in different ways.
Yes, but the manner in which someone reacts is a. I mean, I wasn't going to interpret Sartre, so I don't know about Sartre. But you can, something like that can occur, and then there's a fresh wave of projection.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, wasn't Sartre just projecting his own fear into that being of the tree?
Yeah.
How does he know that he wasn't just seeing inside himself going, fuck, I'm really scared of myself?
Yeah, well, what about the spark of a tree? How does he know that it's just not something inside himself?
That's what I mean, that's what I said.
Yeah, yeah, that's the question, isn't it?
Well, maybe, that's one question.
You know, it's what realness means to you. So if you really register that the tree is real, then you're really real, and then it really matters. Your existence matters. Whereas a lot of the time you're just going along and it's, there's not much difference between stories and us and, you know.
Maybe what motivates him is if he's going around suffering from lack of meaning of his existence, where he feels...
Is this Sartre we're talking about?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, or pretty much everybody in the Western society where we feel our life is just like a... You know, when we look at everybody else and we just think, oh, well, all we're doing is this chain of thing, meaningless, you know, and we're all going to die and all this. And then you kind of start, like, wanting to reconnect with the unity of everything. And then you kind of look at the tree and you kind of experience the tree and you start to experience things in a more kind of like sense that feels more real to you than what you experience than when you just go around in your life and you seek that experience.
But I'm interested now because I spoke about the tree, that the reaction back is, well, that's all just subjective at a certain level, isn't it? That's our cultural reaction to this.
Well, it's quite objective, I would say.
Well, the question of subjectivity and objectivity is central to all of this.
Subjective or broader, whereas what we were just talking about is quite objective.
Because what Heidegger, I mean, if we get to the end, and I've got ambitions to do it, and I guess what you missed from not reading the book from the beginning about what we're talking about is that Heidegger is concerned that to philosophize is to enter into a certain form of attunement. That it's not just a casual affair or a thinking affair. It's the preparation is needed to get into an attunement whereby you can whereby such binding can occur. So he's treating philosophy as a kind of almost a spiritual practice.
So is this possibility of binding?
Yeah, the Eastern religions called lifting the veil of Maya. Yeah, where was I reading Maya? Oh, no, I was reading Jung, that's right. Sorry, that's what he was talking.
Is that the same thing?
Well, I've got a feeling at the level here that if something... that there's something very ordinary in it too. You know, if there's something very ordinary in it too, that if in a situation where something unexpected happens that's quite threatening, you actually do bind to that too, because you're something's at stake here. You don't just in a situation where somebody's attacking you, I think you might come to a position where you actually allow what's actually happening to impinge on you because your life depends on it. It's not. I think this idea of binding isn't. I mean, I'm using examples like this, but I think it's almost there whenever we correctly, and don't ask me what correct means at this point, correctly perceive anything that we haven't seen before.
Jung was right at the same time as Heidegger, and he's got this concept in a different form, hasn't he? He's got introspection and whatever it's called, extroverts. And in introspection, which is the feeling, the meaning of something deeply, you let something play on you, you don't put any barriers. And then, according to him, you spend the rest of the time trying to separate from it inside, because it's been quite overwhelming. And extrovert, basically, is this objectification thing. So he's got the same concept, I think, which might be helpful in reflecting back to Heidegger, because they're working at the same time, slightly different fields, but nonetheless looking at the same problem. So there you go.
I'm doing that at the moment. I've got Heidegger and Jung on the bedside almost. You know, on the bedside table.
Yeah.
So because they both got, they can be complementary in what they're seeing.
Introversion, extroversion, is what I think Heidegger is talking about when he talks about the fluttering of leaves, as you put it, you know, or the waving, or falling in love, or whatever. It's feeling.
But I, in a way, I don't want. I don't think Heidegger would. Those were my examples. They're not Heidegger's examples. I think he'd probably find.
It's the same concept, though.
But he does have a piece. In what is called thinking, where he talks about the blossoming tree, which I feel it would be a good thing to read, but I don't have it immediately with me. Which is yes, Marina.
This grappling with binding as well. Is it to do with some kind of unifying, where rather than the example of seeing the tree and, you know, and the language and getting a sense of the being, well, not rather than, perhaps as well as it's happening, you are experiencing the tree, you are living the tree, you're becoming the tree in that moment, you are the tree, not the tree, not you here observing
yes.
the leaves, but you are the tree.
Yes, or there's a break, there's the ordinary
there's
subjective
the
objective
yes.
division, in some sense, is dissolved. But he's in his earlier work, he talks about allowing. What he's talking about here is just allowing something to show itself from itself as itself. How about that? That was his definition of phenomenology. Allowing something to show itself from itself as itself.
Binding word is.
Well, no, we've got to remember that binding is a translation of a word that Heidegger used in German, I'm not sure what that was. And also, we've got to, in a way, when you're doing philosophy, you've slowly got to unbind yourself from the associations that you might have with a word and allow it to just be a kind of empty so that you can start to investigate what Heidegger might have meant by it rather than what. It's another example, if you like, of an allowing, you know, you've got to kind of allow what Heidegger's saying to kind of permeate that word.
So the binding thing is only happening when you encounter something which is other than your projection.
But that's my language, right? Because,
yeah.
I mean, in a way, I think Heidegger has a kind of a picture here that, coming from being and time, that we're just in an everyday state most of the time. Where we're just hardly conscious, but we have the capacity to be in another state, that's our freedom in a way. Our freedom is to not be entirely fixed in this everyday state of consciousness.
So it's not to do with the individual experience, like the tree, because once you've experienced that, then you build that into your projection.
But the entire state that I think Heidegger is referring to here, of he comes from Kierkegaard that it's in an eye blink, it's an eye blink thing. It
reminds me of Maturana's love state, those moments, you know, like Nicolette was saying, in this room, you know, we're seeing individuals and we've got all kinds of stereotypes and projections. But there are moments when we're in the love state,
yeah,
and all of that just melts, and we're just together, you know, being.
Yes.
Well, you can be together and not in love.
No.
No,
you don't
think so.
No.
I think you can be
not in love.
Not in love, but
yeah.
in the vibe.
Yeah.
vibration of love.
No, I disagree. Status. I disagree. I think you can be in the state of hate and still be together, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly connected, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Hegel says that, doesn't he? That
who does?
Hegel. That which you hate, you're dependent on.
Right.
Yeah.
Big connected
yes.
in amusement,
can't
you? Oh, you can all see the joke.
What a joy.
Yeah.
A joy.
Yeah.
But
yes.
I'm talking
yeah.
about
yeah.
a different kind of connection.
Yeah, but if you yeah,
but I'm just giving my opinion.
Yeah, no,
but I would I just in this if Heidegger doesn't talk about love, or very rarely does he mention the word. It does crop up, but he never makes it central.
Mm.
But I think the sense here is, again, it's like the word binding. We need to sort of know what we mean by the word, because it's not at all clear what we mean by the word love. But I think... can I finish? Sorry.
Oh, no, can I just say one?
Can I finish?
I really want to say this. I think if you have the right intentions, that doesn't necessarily equate to love. I mean, if you want to do good for someone, it doesn't mean that you love them.
Yes, but I'm... what Marina, I think, what she communicated is what Heidegger's talking about in this phenomenological place of being opened to being, which is an allowing something to manifest. If you hate something, you're not in a state of allowing it to manifest as itself from itself, and I think there's a base state of pure openness where you if you like that allowing is there, and you could call that place of openness, which is an allowing, a place of love, but it doesn't mean that you I love that person, or I love that person, or it's not to do with individuals. It's to do with an allowing some. It's an allowing another to manifest.
The binding is more like an interlacing or a weaving.
So, John,
I have an
example
yes.
that I might share. I don't know if this is related to what binding means. So, I'm attending a prerequisite course in counselling at Brighton Uni on a Monday night, and we spend 2 hours of the 3 hours, one's a listener and one's a talker in practising counselling, and there's seven of us in the course, and we know each other a little bit, probably before, it's the fourth week in, and so we're on a certain level with each other in the tea break or whatever. And then, of course, one of you is a listener, and the focus is on how you listen and everything, and you tape it. And the other's the talker. So I had an experience last Monday night of being the listener. And I know the lady, she was my talker, in other words, the client. And I'd just known her superficially as you are as students, a bit like how we are here a little bit. And then I listened to her and she talked just for 10 minutes. And I'm not going to tell you what we talked about, or what she talked about, but during that 10 minutes of what she wanted to talk about, you choose whatever you want to talk about from your life, or can be very ordinary, or it can be quite important to you. And it seems to be that everyone wants to talk about something really important, rather than just a superficial thing. And she talked about something that's very, very important to her life. And her whole way of being, from the beginning of the 10 minutes to the end of the 10 minutes, totally changed in that listening, in me listening, and occasionally reflecting and stuff like that. So is that a binding, like, here we were at the top level, sit down, and then at the end of the 10 minutes... we connected it, and she connected it to something in her in a different place, completely from the girl up the top here, or the young woman up the top here. Is that what's binding? So you would feel, and then at the end, we're all in a different, we're together there as two people who don't know each other, not really, and we have come into some different place together. We have, definitely. Is that a binding?
Well, I think in a pure listening to someone else, pure listening, where as you, you know, the binding is a kind of a negation of your projection, of your understanding of somebody.
Because I had a projection of who this girl lady is, yes. Okay, which is a young woman. Not a nasty projection or anything like that, but just, you know, we have personas and we see each other at that level. You know,
can I just say something about, you know, because projection is, it's, I don't want to say it's something wicked. It's absolutely essential that we do. If we didn't, in some sense, project, we'd make no sense of what's going on. But it's to do with an allowing something to come back and determine that. You know, in some sense, your experience is the meeting of your projection with what's coming toward it. Mm-hmm. We can't say what that is, but something's coming toward your projection, and the binding is the allowing of the what's coming towards your projection to determine it.
So God says that you are, the beginning is the word makes light and dark, and then he actually binds and says, I like light and dark, that's quite good. Yeah, basically you're saying. So God is doing this objective projection thing in creating a material universe, and then he likes the material universe and binds with it and says, oh, that's good, I like light and dark, doesn't he?
Well, now this is more that.
Yeah, I think that sort of kind of positive, negative,
yeah.
Proton thing going on.
Yeah.
But I'm talking more about this.
So is that binding, John?
What you were talking about.
Or is that just something else?
Well, no, I think a binding occurs whenever you let another person. We say in, don't we? But letting another person in is in some sense allowing them to show themselves to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens.
Yes.
In that particular 10 minutes.
Yes.
That's what happens.
And you know what, you know, it's, you know, it's rare, it doesn't happen that often. You know, most of the time you're just meeting someone's projection. You know, you feel it.
But if you go online and listen to empaths talking, they have it all the time. They've got a real problem with it. They can't actually, they haven't got enough of the objective separation. And they go through hell because the impressions, the binding they get all the time, is really horrendous. You know, it's all the time, you know. So I don't think it's types. Different types get different experiences and different amounts of different experiences.
I feel Heidegger's kind of just chalked into the room, and he's he hasn't, all right. But my, I feel we have to, even though I'm not, I'm doing my best, we have to approach Heidegger, we don't have to, but, you know, in what is called thinking, he said the most thought-provoking thing in these thought-provoking times is that we're not thinking yet. You see, we always want to get, what does binding mean? We want to grab it, and we want to say, right, that's what binding means. And in a sense, to be true to what Heidegger's saying here, we have to stay in a place of not knowing what binding means. And just follow on with what he's saying. Thinking that you understand what Heidegger's saying in a way is a closing off of what he's saying, because what he's saying, what he's talking of is the manifestness of being, and the only thing that this is about is the manifestness of beings plural, and if you like, the idea I think Heidegger has is to lead us into a place where we experience that. Not conceptualize it, but experience it. And you see, all the way along the way, if you want to try and nail it down into a concept, it means this, it means this, it means this. Oh, got it now, I can go off. That's not what it's about. He's trying in this entire book, right at the very end, he's trying to say nobody really experiences what the world is. And if you're going to experience what world is, it's going to be in an eye blink. And he's interested in whether or not anyone who's reading this is going to have that eye blink experience of ah. And it's got a quick ah in it, in the sense that whatever you try and say afterwards to explain what it is not going to be it. And yet, how else are we going to
well, you're
encounter it?
The fact you had an experience, you're not actually explaining that experience. To say, well, this seems to be like when I fell in love. You're not saying I can explain love, or I rationally can put all the compartments of love. You're just saying that he seems to be talking about the sort of thing that I experienced when I experienced love. And that was a really big eye blink, or I experienced a tree. I sat and I saw the flutters, the amazing flutters. Like a lot of the painters actually paint, don't they? They paint these moments, don't they, of the fluttering leaves, or the power of colour, and the way that a flower just sings to the sun, and things like that. These are the moments he's talking about, and I think we can identify, it's valid, I think, even in a Heideggerian way, to identify you've had the experience, because he is working from an experience, without actually saying, I want to explain it. I don't want to explain it. I mean, I could, but not in this session, because this is about Heidegger, and Heidegger is not interested in explaining it. He doesn't go that far with his philosophy.
You can't explain it. So do you, in the realm of explaining, that you've lost experience?
Well, no, the point is you have to go to a different type of philosophy to start to explain.
Well, no, but that's what Heidegger said, but you can't.
Well, he can't. I mean, let's not put him as the god of everybody.
No, but that's what he said.
He's just one of 9 million people, and he says you can't. He says you can't.
But we're trying to understand that.
Well, to understand why he can't do it.
Yeah,
so
it's
to understand
that's valid.
It's in him, isn't it?
But that's what we're trying to
understand. So, Michael, once again, see, what this class is about is about attempting to enter into what Heidegger's talking about.
Yeah.
And do you see that, as gently as I say, do you see that you're working against that?
No.
No, you don't. It's all right. You don't see that. That's fine. You don't see that. It's all right.
I have to say, Michael, that I found your interjections interesting, but very distracting and very confusing.
Okay, fair.
And I'm struggling to understand. I mean, unlike you, I think Heidegger's a complete shit. Trust me. And my background is Catholic and Jewish, so I'm with you on that. However, that be that as it may, I'm struggling to understand that and what it might reveal to me, and I find your interjections quite distracting and confusing, and I would like to be able to understand that I interject as well, but I'd like to be able to understand this or get some grasp of it, because I've read it and to me it was impenetrable. But I'm beginning to have some sense of it now, and I'd like to be able to deepen that sense, Michael. Well, I hope you don't mind me saying that.
No, please.
If we're talking about it, I also want to add that my feeling is that we are now looking at text that was written back in the last century, in the 30s or 20s, and we have moved a lot with our understanding, partly because of these kind of things, and I'm just wondering how groundbreaking was it at the time, this kind of realization about the dichotomy of the subjectivity of our perception of the world versus... Was it kind of quite a new concept?
Now, once again, it depends who you ask, doesn't it? I mean, if you ask me, I from my sort of journey through the halls of philosophy, various universities, I don't think Heidegger's understood yet. I'm with him. I think the most thought-provoking thing in these thought-provoking times is that we aren't thinking yet. So... Similarly with Jung, the whole of psychology isn't yet to catch up with Jung. So this sort of sense, it's 2020 and we're way ahead of all of that. I don't find that's not how I see it. I see the things Heidegger had to say are still waiting to be. I don't know if they're ever going to be generally understood. But even amongst the people who claim to be Heideggerians, I haven't found much. You know, people have failed to enter into what Heidegger has to say and then come out again. Do you know, it's like there are various ways that you can approach Heidegger, and of course you can understand Heidegger without actually entering into what he says, because you already disagree with him. If you see what I mean, if you already disagree with him, you're never going to get to what he means, to what's essentially at the core of him. You have to cut him an enormous amount of slack to get there, and very few people seem to be willing to do that, especially now, right? That's why I started off with his biography. You know, he's already, you know, the door's already more or less closing on him, and you know, the whole of German culture is discredited, essentially, isn't it? And you may say for good reason. So that's. I'm going to read the rest of this slide, because that seems to be the only way we're going to get out of it. When we say that this ability to point out is grounded in being free for beings as such, because I think Heidegger is going to help us, you know. This entails that the logos does not first produce a relation toward beings as such, but for its part is grounded in such a relation. Is anyone at a loss with what that means?
Could you repeat that, please?
Yeah, when we say that this ability to point out the logos apophantikos is grounded in being free for beings as such, this entails that the logos does not first produce a relation towards beings as such, but for its part is grounded in such a relation. So this is just Heidegger's setting out his schema, if you like. Up here is our rational thinking, our logos thinking, if you like. And he's saying that it's grounded in something else. Let's just call it something else. Yes? For now. And he's just going to talk about this. He's going to say, I'm going to see if you can see that our logos, our assertions, are grounded in something else. And we're leaving the something else in quotes, if you like.
Do you think he leaves it in quotes because it's unique to everyone? Or universal? Does he think that
doesn't leave it in quotes? We're leaving.
No, I'm leaving in quotes. But I think it's a one. It's the one and the many again, like we were talking about last week. It's the one world that manifests to all of us, but it manifests to all of us in different ways. So the logos can point out beings as they are, and in such pointing out, point toward whatever pertains to those beings, or direct away whatever does not pertain to them. And he's not talking mystically here. He's just saying the logos, apophantikos, logical language, can say the board is black, that's pointing towards it, or the board is not white, and the not white, in a way, is pointing away from it. So he's just saying, we have this capacity, right? No problem with that. It can only do this if it already, and the already is the a priori for Heidegger, the already. So already means before we come to speak in logos terms, if it already has the possibility in the general of measuring this pointing out, and whether it suitably conforms to those beings. All right, he's trying to say, when I say the board is black, there's been a measuring and a conforming to something that's already manifest. he's saying almost the reverse of something Bortov was saying. He Bortov almost seemed to be saying last week that when you say the board is black, you suddenly make the board clear. Yes, there was an element of that last week. It was Heidegger saying something different here. He's saying, no, the way we ordinarily use language, the logos, clearly we don't make the blackboard manifest. But when we make such an assertion, there's a measuring against something else. Again, we're keeping the something else, because we think we know what the something else is. We think it's a bunch of atoms and molecules or whatever, you know. But that's why we're keeping it as phenomenologists. We're just keeping the... I'd like to say we don't know what the thing is we're measuring against.
Sorry, I thought Bortov was saying that manifesting quality of language was not something that occurred in everyday speech. It's only when you acquire that word.
Yes.
It's not something that happens all the time. I say table and oh, there it is. It's only that when I learn...
Yes. Yes, I was being unfair to Bortov.
Yeah.
It appeared sometimes that it was as if when I used the word water, that makes water appear.
Yeah.
And he wasn't strictly saying that.
No.
He was saying when I denote water, I don't make it appear, but it's the language that discloses water.
Yes.
So he does understand Heidegger, but in effect, I wanted to point out that Heidegger doesn't say that language is disclosing anything here.
Okay.
He's just saying, here we are in this discourse, and there's something behind it.
Yeah.
Yes?
He does seem to be alluding to a unitary, though, similar to Bortov, in that, like Bortov said, that in a sense, water does need to appear for me to talk about it, to have the word for water. And it seems as similar there, just he hasn't sort of mentioned what it is that's appearing yet.
Yes. And also remembering that in Bortov had this kind of time, right, this downstream. So when we're speaking like this and reflecting, we're downstream. You know, the logos apophantikos is downstream of the manifestation, and you can pull yourself back.
And it must be because we can talk about things without them being manifest.
Yes.
I can say water is wet and there's no water around. And so nothing's manifest.
Yes.
So in a way, our logical language doesn't actually... It's kind of detached itself
from
the beings themselves.
But that's a good example, though, isn't it? Because when you say water is wet, when we were talking about pure projection, that's a pure projection.
Mm.
There's been no measuring or binding in that.
Mm. No.
Yes, the measuring or binding only comes when what's manifest is actually manifest. Yes. That's a sort of example where you see we live in that stream of our own thought, our own understanding. In order to be able to comport himself, and comportment is an important word for Heidegger, comportment is something that only humans can do. We comport ourselves. That means we already live in an understanding of being. In order to be able to comport himself in general within this either or, man, and we must breed man and woman here, in his... By the way, I don't know if you follow this, but somewhere for Heidegger, very unusually, actually says him or her in this.
He does towards the end.
He does. Yeah. Because of course, he'd had... Yeah. Because it was... I forget her name now.
Hannah Arendt,
yes. Who basically rehabilitated him after the war. It was only on her say-so that he was allowed back into... The French allowed him back into his teaching post. So, in order to be able to comport himself in general within this either-or, man in his propositional discourse must have leeway in advance for the comparative to and fro of the either-or of truth or falsity. I mean, again, there's something here I find very hard to point out behind that. That's a surface statement, and behind that... the whole idea that something can be true or false is there's an essential connection between that and freedom, which I find very hard to articulate, even though I've got a glimpse of it. I have an eye and blink of it. You see, for a computer program that's been programmed to accurately detect that there are tables and chairs in the room, it will say there is a table in the room, and that would be a true proposition, but it has no truth because it has no leeway. For it, there is no truth. It's just a machine following a series of steps.
It doesn't understand what a table is.
But do you see how there's something here? Do you see that it's essentially, if we are like that computer, we're just utterly determined by our atoms and molecules and neurons firing away in our brains. There's no truth for us.
Because it's all deterministic.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how to express it any differently, except there's no truth unless there's the freedom to be wrong. The whole idea of the being truth, truth disappears in that, in essentially in what it is. If there's no freedom to be untrue, do you see it? It only opens
it's like
up.
Like René Magritte, a pipe is not a pipe. You know, like,
he's
got a picture of a pipe, and he says, "This is not a pipe," and you're looking at a pipe.
Mm. I don't know that one. No,
no.
I don't. But
yes.
No.
But we have, as humans, we have the freedom.
Yes, but it's not. It's not just that. It's that. There's because there are philosophers who say that we're completely determined, and claim that that's a truth, and there's an essential contradiction in there, if in saying that they were just following a program, and they had absolutely no freedom whatsoever, and they're just like the computer saying, it's a truth that I'm completely determined. Do you see there's an essential impossibility in that?
Is he in a paradox here? Is he in that space of paradox where truth and falsity?
In this level, he's still in the he's still talking about truth and falsity from the perspective of logos apophantikos, which is a binary. It's either true or false. So he's still in that binary world. But he's saying even in that binary world, where we use logic to say there's a table here, and it's not a chair. There's nothing paradoxical in it, but in order for that to be true, we had to allow the being of the table to conform in us, and we had the freedom to not let it conform, and to say there's a chair. Mm. You see it at every moment, when even in simple language, where there's a freedom hovering over us. That if we didn't have that freedom, then there'd be no truth anymore. There'd just be a machine making noises.
I think our freedom consists in being bigger than language, encompassing language, so that I have a sense that when I say that is a table, I could also say that that is not a table.
Yes. You've got, and we have an essential freedom.
And I know that the table is still there.
Yes, but there's a level here where, you know, there's a lot of determination going on. Because if you said it's a chair, then everyone would start saying, "Time to cart you off." You know that you know there are certain consequences to.
I'm having the same difficulty I had last week, John, which is that we keep looking at these concrete things and as examples.
Yes.
And yet what we're reading is not really to do with the concrete. So it does, you know, I'm having that interference, that gap all the time, thinking a table is not a good example. But, you know, I'm not able to
to think what might be a good example. But it's just striking me each time I hear a concrete example, like a table or a cup. It doesn't seem to be the example. If he's talking either or.
So let's...
Either or.
Let's get, because he means to do this.
Mm-hmm.
He means to introduce us to the Logos Apophantikos, which is concrete examples like, I mean, his example is the board is black. So he means us to enter into understanding the Logos Apophantikos.
So what is black? The board is black. Okay, the board, that is like saying the table, and then you say the table is brown.
Yeah.
So what is brown? What is black? And to me, it's the what is the black as opposed to the table or the board. So I'm just expressing my what's going on within me at the moment, appearing a concrete example when what I'm reading and is coming as you know to make sense of it is not about concrete. So am I?
I think you're getting.
I just want to stay
yes,
with it, you know.
Yes.
I'm just sharing what's going on within me. It's the same thing.
But I think you're. We're going somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going towards. The board is badly positioned, and that's when, if you like, something else opens up.
Mm-hmm.
So. So I'm starting with the board is black because that's the classic. Heidegger is in a way wanting to show that this form of language is just floating on top of something else. But he wants to illustrate it by going into this form of language first.
Yeah.
Yes.
Getting that there's only truth when you're interacting with things, and so you have this collection of knowledge that's you, when you connect to things, you change little pieces, and then while you're doing that, then you get truth, but it's not relevant once you're outside of now, once you're not interacting with things. None
yes.
of that is truth, because it's only truth when it's actually this, it's now. When
yeah.
You're interacting with what's now.
And it's it's an unconcealment as well. I always feel like it's like you're pulling the blanket back, and it's the unconcealedness, which is what Heidegger takes truth to be, is always now. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, that was. Did I get to the end of that?
No.
Am I on the last paragraph? So,
yeah.
In order to be able to comport, I know we have said that, we need leeway in advance for the comparative to and fro of the either or of truth or falsity. Even, Marina, in the logical language of Logos Apophantikos, we have this either or.
Mm.
It's grown out of something more fundamental. But. And Heidegger wants to say, do you see the structure of the Logos? You've got to see it as it is, and then we're looking down into where it emerges from, what it takes for granted. He must have leeway within which those beings that assertion is to be about are themselves manifest. This entails the essential point that not only does the Logos Apophantikos not produce our relation to beings, it does not even produce this manifestness of beings. It always already merely makes use of both that relation and this manifestness in order to fulfill its potential as a revealing or concealing that points out. That's slide one. And slide two, because we're going to have a break soon. I'm going to read the whole slide, all right? I won't comment on it. We'll just get to the end of the slide first, yes, and then we might let it sit, see what we make of it. In making the true assertion, the board is black. I'm glad it's come. This being that we call a board does not first become manifest to us in the way that it is through this true statement as such. although it's not a true statement for us. We have to actually transpose ourselves. When Heidegger was, this is an actual Heidegger lecture, and there really was a blackboard in the room, just to, so you picture it, and he had a lectern there where he was delivering the lecture, and the board was in the corner of the room. That's that you, and it's got tiers of seats going up to the ceiling. So, I mean, they're not manifest to us, but that's the context within which he was speaking. I said I wouldn't interrupt myself tonight. Yes, the board, this being that we call a board does not first become manifest to us in such a way that it, it's as though the assertion as such were capable of opening up to us this being that was previously closed off. The assertion, although it opens up in its own way, I can't just read it. I just mention it. It opens up in its own way, as in it. What the assertion does is it out of the whole lecture theatre. It pulls the blackness of the board up, doesn't it? It's like almost like an assertion. It's like a big magnifying glass,
and suddenly
the thing that it makes the foreground. It magnifies something and pulls it into the foreground. So it is a pointing out and a showing, right? At a certain level.
Yeah, focus.
Yeah. But in a way, it's got this amazing ability to just stuff that you weren't explicitly aware of. It'll just bring it in, and then we move on. Bring something like our discourse now. We're doing it. You know, we're pulling stuff up into consciousness, into the foreground all the time. That's the manner of which our language works.
But in terms of blackboard, you've got black, like you mentioned, what is black? That is seeing. But what if you were blind? What would black be in terms of thinking? Like, I can understand board.
Yes.
Can you? Actually, I'm not sure about board either. But if you were blind,
In terms of thinking, what would it be? With the, if you couldn't see, then you'd have the spatial form of the board, but in relation to blackness, we've already been here in a way, haven't we? With Verena's remembering being blind. Mm. I don't know. You see, you'd have to. It's like, what's it like to be a bat in a way?
Yeah.
To what's it like to have never seen colour?
Never seen a bat. Like, say if you've never seen a bat. Because I can't.
No, you can imagine.
You can understand colour because you can see colour in your mind. You can.
But can someone who's never seen colour see colour?
You can still see colour when you're blind, can't you?
Well, Marina thought so. Didn't you?
Well, I certainly had an experience of light, not colour. But when I read of people who are blind actually touching materials and saying what colour it is, I mean, that baffles me, but you gave an explanation for that.
Did
but
I?
In terms of, like, when, like, was
so
there anything mysterious about, like the objects in reality when you were blind that you didn't know in terms of language? Like, you didn't know what it was?
Jean's explanation was that I already had language, otherwise I couldn't
but
say.
But was there anything that you didn't know?
But in my experience, I was seeing things and experiencing things that I had, that's not to do with this present lifetime.
Yeah, but was there an object that you didn't know of?
Yeah.
Did you know
there
of
were
all
lots
you,
of different
lots
objects.
Of, and how did you think about them?
Well, in that time, and as I was, and I was a child still, there was a lack of understanding of certain things, but there was an understanding of certain things.
Yes,
that I was
there was still some thinking processes going
yeah.
on.
So
yeah.
The main thing in explaining that was that I was surprised later on and had to check out with people who are blind whether when they're blind they actually have light or dark, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And what did they say?
Well, light.
So there's something like monochrome, as in just a distinction?
No, it was a hazy light, like when the sun is shining through and it's, like a misty morning, that kind of light. But if you had asked me before that experience, my just general assumption was that people who were blind was in darkness. And, I mean, I haven't asked the world of people who are blind whether they all see light, but certainly the ones I've asked say they see light. They're not in darkness, as it is.
Yeah, because darkness is of the night. Yes. You've been in light all day, so you respond to it as darkness.
Yes.
But it would stop being relevant, and then it
would
be a thing, wouldn't it?
Yes, now, here I was. I'm going to read this slide. Yes. So the Logos, the third paragraph. The Logos apophantikos merely takes a part in the assertion what is already manifest. Just quickly there. The board is black has not only taken the board and blown it up, but it's taken the blackness and separated it from the board. And this is synthesis diuresis, which if you've did your reading and translated it, this is what Aristotle is talking about. But at the same time, you see, the board is black has separated board and blackness, but at the same time it said that they belong together. Do you see that it does both? It's a taking apart and a putting together. If you assert anything about anything, you've not just pulled the thing out, but you've in a simple apophantic statement, you've separated some aspect or quality or property of the thing, which is separated things. But the very statement and the copula in the middle puts them together again. Do you see? So it's like a separation and then a rejoining. But the rejoining has emphasised not just the board, but the separation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's what I was calling a paradox, because rather than being joining together, they're oscillating together.
Yeah.
You know, they're not. It's not that and then that. It's
all the everything at once.
It's everything
yes.
at once.
Yeah. Yes. No, you're right. Then. That, I wasn't following you, but that's it's synthesis and diuresis is a taking apart and a putting together at the same time, and which is a paradox, isn't it?
The other thing I wanted to check, John, when you were talking to Maria there, and how we're adding time to this as we are here talking. Because, and this might be just a belief of mine, that as humans, we are capable and do what Heidegger's talking about all the time. We haven't got to get to some really advanced state, you know, to be doing this. We're doing it all the time because we are human, you know.
When you say doing it, do you...
We have moments, like you mentioned with the tree. you know, like your moment with the tree, I might have a moment with a stone on the beach.
Yes.
Blake had a moment with the sand.
Yes.
You know, and I think we're in a kind of culture where everything is kind of hierarchical, and, you know, we have the elites and we have the experts and they've got it. And at one moment, I can't remember what it was you said, it just struck me that we have it in these moments. We have moments of it all the time.
Yes.
But we're just not expanded in that. So, and, you know, wouldn't be able to write like Heidegger, but he is talking about a human condition that is open to all of us.
It's like how we're made, it's how we're constantly...
Yes.
When we connect with new things, that causes change in us, and that's life, isn't it?
So
But I'm further than that. I mean, my sense is again that there's a certain, you know, I said it's amnesia, really. What we're talking about here, this manifestness of being, is occurring every moment, and that a certain in the background, there's something in us that's in that place. Right, it's not out there, it's not actually in us. I mean, I think this is where we have got to subjectivity and objectivity. We're talking about something that's neither one nor the other, but we're not. If we weren't in it, we'd have no experience at all. Do you know, it's that we're, in a way, our attention is focused on the foreground of the logos apophanticus thinking that's going on in us. But that doesn't mean the other isn't going on in us. It's just that we choose to be looking in the other direction. I mean, Heidegger, in a way, his whole attempt here is to say no, you can't look into the background, but you can broaden you can become open to it.
That's so a different. More and more aware of.
Yes, but it's already there.
It's already there.
You haven't made it appear. It's just that you're not attending to it.
Yeah, I was thinking about. Have we got time for this? What time?
Yeah, we're going to have lunch.
I was thinking about the background before I came. Well, I wrote on the River, didn't I? Something about I can't remember now. So when you're doubting something, what you're actually doing is you're doubting something. But really, what you're actually doing is doubting. It's an action. It's a thing. It is what it is. So. Behind the doubting is an action, which is certain. It's like a certain principle. So it can't be doubting because you're actually doubting. Do you know what I mean? The action of doubting is a certain principle. Like a question is just a question behind what it is. So in front of it, you're questioning something.
Yes.
That's the foreground. But behind it, it is what it is. It's a question, really.
Yes.
It's an intention. So you've got more space there, you've got more subjectivity. It's not just in the foreground, you haven't got an object, which is your question, but behind it you've got the action.
Yes.
Which is where you're questioning.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's I think you're going back into that's the manifesting of every moment.
Yeah.
And if it's a doubting,
yeah.
You know, the doubting throws you into what you're doubting. The subject matter, the subject matter of it.
Yeah, but that's what's going
but
on.
But the reality is, there's just
you might be doubting something.
Yes.
In the foreground, but in the background, what's really going on is that you're just doubting.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Bortov's, I know you weren't here for that part of the reading, but that's his entire thing really. That the going downstream is where everything gets separated out, and the coming back upstream is everything is just appearing. Including your doubting.
No, but I mean, sometimes, like, I could be so far away from what I'm actually doing. Like, I had a glimpse of it yesterday after reading Heidegger. My mind was on my cat, and I was so far away from... I was thinking about something else, I was doing something else, I was far away from it. But where my moment was in myself was with my cat. I had a glimpse. That's where I was present. My thought, my thinking... was present, was with my cat, but everything else was somewhere else. But I had a glimpse of it,
yeah.
So that's what Heidegger, I think, had an influence on, seeing where I was actually at, really, at that point, which was like, oh, okay, just a seeing thing. Sorry, it's really boring.
It's all right, no.
That was
no.
So boring,
no.
I'm so
in
sorry.
Yeah,
it's my cat, I know.
So where was I? Am I down to the last paragraph?
Yeah, something like that.
I was talking about taking apart. That's where we were. So on the third paragraph, second sentence, there does indeed lie a being true or being false in the assertion. Indeed, the assertion is even the form in which being true and being false are commonly expressed, passed on and communicated. Yet this does not at all entail that propositional truth is the fundamental form of truth. If we say that what is true is whatever is valid, and continue, there is something valid only where there is acknowledgement, and acknowledgement is the expression and fundamental act of affirmation, and affirmation is the fundamental form of judgment, then truth... as validity is connected with judgment as affirmation. All right? So he's just describing a certain understanding that all truth is really contained in the logos apophantikos, that truth is a matter of statements conforming to states of affairs. Yes? And if the statement conforms to the state of affairs, then the statement is true. But the site of truth is in language, the Logos Apophanticus language. Yes, that without such language, there isn't any truth. Truth resides in that form of language. And he's saying, well, insofar as you think that way, then this can't be refuted, because it's got a certain understanding of what the essence of truth is already. You know, it's like truth's a term, like all philosophical terms, it's kind of up for grabs. Yes, there's a certain level where you can define what truth is, because this is philosophy. Where phenomenology comes in is, it says, well, we're looking at the phenomenon of truth, whether there's a phenomenon that corresponds to truth. Heidegger is saying, but the question is validity the essence of truth, or is this characterization of truth as validity and validation not the most trivial and superficial interpretation, one that only the sound common sense of routine thought can and must hit upon? To which, you know, this is Heidegger's it's not an argument, right? He's not arguing. He's just saying from where I am coming from, from my understanding, from having seen the manifestness of being, then this is a trivial and superficial interpretation, but it's not false. It depends on where you're coming from. So in a way, an analytic philosopher would then expect, okay, so now present your arguments. Yeah, what do you mean? You're just calling me names, right? You're saying all that I think is trivial and superficial. So, well, let's hear your arguments. But Heidegger, in a way, I think that he almost finds this amusing. He just leaves it at that. You know, just leaves it at that. Says, isn't it? Isn't this a superficial understanding of truth? To which I think, if he was forced to give an answer, he would say, well, if you can get a glimpse of what I'm talking about, you'll come to see it that way too. It's not an argument, it's an invitation. I think it is lunchtime now.